horizon. He pulled out carefully and gathered speed on the road. Finn resisted talking about himself. With a sudden pang, I realised I was missing Hamish, who talked about himself all the time. "You will proper hurt yourself if you don't eat more."
"Yeah," said Finn, frowning and watching the rear view. "Fucking thanks for that, that's really helpful."
The road was empty.
"But you will." "Who is Sophie Buchanan?"
"You will damage yourself permanently."
"What's her real name?"
We had reached a companionable deadlock and drove in silence. For a brief moment, the North Sea opened up on the left. Lights from a row of oil platforms glinted in the dark like misplaced Christmas trees. Albert told me to get rid of Finn and keep hiding. It would suit him and Teagler if I did. I thought about the other girl, my shadow self, the me-shaped vacuum at my side. She hid, and she died. It wasn't safe to keep hiding, but the habit was so dear to me, I wasn't ready to give it up. I thought of Leon marrying Gretchen Teagler. Was that so bad? Maybe he didn't know about her. But I listened to my thought process and noticed that I was desperate for Leon to be a good man, and he clearly wasn't. Everyone knew what Gretchen was like. When I thought back at the way he told his tales, looking away, stealing cigarettes from someone working a chambermaid's job, he wasn't sharing stories with me. He was practicing for another audience. God, I was awful at choosing friends. We drove quietly down the dark road as I considered all of this.
"So, Anna Sophie, how far from those men is far enough?"
"Very."
"I don't suppose you brought your passport with you?"
"I did, actually."
"Okay."
It took a while for me to realise we were heading to Inverness Airport.
I couldn't fly. My passport was a dead person's and would set off alarms at every border agency desk in the country.
But that crisis was an hour away, so I sat back and enjoyed the drive. Chapter 29. The airport was small. The calm sea was on our left, an empty car park in front of us, the bright airport building on our right. A runway ran between the back of the terminal and the fast road to Nairn. Through the glass walls of the building, we could see a steward sitting at a desk, puffy-faced and caked in makeup, getting through her early shift. We went in. She said there were no international flights until the next day, but we could get to London and connect from there. We stepped aside for a chat, and Finn said we could hide out at his friend's castle in France, near Clermont-Ferrand. Maybe we could get there via the Ile de Ré. We could retrace the Parkers' movement in the town, go and see the Airbnb man and ask him about seeing Violetta, about the person he saw on deck that night. I said, yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to do that. I was agreeing to everything because I wasn't going. I was going to run. I bought us two cheap tickets on the first flight out. I didn't need to use my passport because the flight was domestic, leaving for Gatwick at 6:20 a.m. It was 4 in the morning. We had over 2 hours to wait. We sat on seats and I nodded along as Finn messaged Trina Keeney to ask if we could quiz her about Leon's financial situation. Maybe we could buy her a coffee? He signed it Finn Cohen, the currency of celebrity. Most of us would just ask the question. But I agreed to all of this and more because I had no intention of getting on the plane. Finn was tired. He wanted to go through security and hang about by the departures gate, drinking machine coffee and dozing on the chairs. The airport was very small. Once I was through security, I'd be trapped. I said I needed a bit of time alone, and I'd go and move Hamish's car to the long-stay car park. He was suspicious of that and insisted on giving me his phone number and made me call him so that he had mine.
So, was it a Van Gogh?
What?
Did you steal a Van Gogh from them?
Yes.
Worth it then. He sighed and stood up slowly.
I need to lie down or I'll fall down.
I stood up with him. I'll move the car to somewhere less obvious. He said,
I don't know if you've flown with this company before, but you have to get here 30 minutes before the flight time or they won't let you on.
I nodded.
Seriously? I've been refused at security while the plane was sitting at the gate.
Okay. I watched him go through to departures. A lone security guard waited patiently, shifting from foot to foot. I could see past the conveyor belt, through the frame of the metal detector, to rows of seats and glass windows overlooking the small runway. Finn walked over, handed his ID to the security guard, emptied his pockets, took off his shoes and shed his jacket into a basin. He gave me a tiny wave and went through. He was a nice man, really. I went back to the car. A gale was whistling far off in the North Sea, lifting white horses near the shore. I pulled my coat closed and stood to look, opening my face to the wind. Out there, hundreds of miles away, my girls were safely tucked up in little beds, lashes resting on fondant skin, soft hair sliding off pillow cliffs. When the sun came up, they would choose a cereal and drink milk and go swimming. My children were safe. It was all that mattered to me. I would run, draw whoever came next away from them. Maybe the other girl had kids. Maybe she thought of them when the men came for her. Maybe her last thought was about her kids, and maybe she felt grateful that they were safe. The bonnet of Hamish's car was buckled where it had smashed the door off the other car. I ran my fingers along the gash at the side and got back in. I started the engine, leaving the lights off, and reversed through the empty car park until I reached a drop-off point. Finn might come out to look for me. If I left now and he found me gone, he might call the cops. I wanted him safe. I decided to wait until his plane took off. If he came out, I'd find some other method of getting away from him. I put the radio onto a soul station and listened for a while, trying to revive my comforting thoughts about the girls. I couldn't quite get it back. I knew other men would come for me because I had reappeared, and they'd keep coming for me until they made me go away forever. It was about money, unless Albert had been lying about the stadium sell-off, but I didn't think he was. He didn't think it mattered what he told me, expected me to be dead by now. It felt too boring and specific to be a lie, but I googled the football club. They were indeed renovating their stadium. A statement from the board of directors said they were looking forward to reopening in 3 years' time. I first noticed the headlights in the corner of my eye. A car coming off the main road, taking the airport turn too fast. Judging from the wide axle and high roof, it was a jeep. I got out of Hamish's car and shut the door, crouched down and backed off between two nearby parked cars. I watched. The jeep cut across the empty car park and stopped near the main entrance. A figure in black got out and jogged into the terminal. As he walked along the bright inside concourse, I saw it was the man with the knife. His left jaw was red and swollen. He looked very angry. The security guard at departures took his phone and scanned an e-ticket, checked a credit card for ID and ordered him to take his shoes off and put them in a basin on the conveyor belt. It took him an age to get them off. Lace-up combat boots. I rang Finn and whispered, "Hide! Knife man's coming in." He hung up. I waited, watching the jeep from the side of the cars. It moved to the nearest disabled parking space and waited, engine running. In the light from the terminal, I could see Albert was driving. He looked my way and sat up suddenly. He peered. He had spotted Hamish's car. Suddenly a light went on inside the Jeep, and Albert reached down to pick up a phone. He was taking a call. Now very bright headlights were approaching, and a bus glided in from the main road. It did a full circuit of the airport car park one-way system before coming to rest right in front of the entrance. Albert was still on his call, but watched the bus carefully. A few passengers tumbled off and disappeared into the side door of the terminal. Workers. There was no one waiting to get on, but the bus idled, engine rumbling. Albert hung up. He looked at Hamish's car again. He looked at the bus. A slow-moving luggage cart trundled around the pavement side of the building, parking parallel to the bus. The cart driver climbed out, walked up to the bus door and waved hello to the driver. The bus driver waved back, pressed a button and the side of the bus opened to a cavernous boot. The cart driver walked back and started loading the big boxes into it. Albert watched, bending forward in his seat, frustrated that he couldn't see. Then he got out, leaving the Jeep door open and hurried around the bus to see. But the cart driver had finished loading and slapped the chassis of the bus twice, signalling to the driver who pressed a button to shut the boot. The panel closed over just as Albert arrived round the side. He hurried back to the Jeep. Our plane was taking off in 33 minutes. I wanted to call Finn again, check he was safe, but he might be hiding and his phone might not be on silent and I might give him away. The bus drew out, coming straight towards me, lights brushing the top of my head. I lay on my stomach and rolled underneath one of the cars. When the bus passed, I raised my head and saw a second set of lights. The Jeep was following the bus away from the airport terminal. They thought we were in that boot. As they passed, I saw that Albert wasn't alone. Knife Man was in the passenger seat. I waited until the lights were past me, until they hit the roundabout, and then I rang Finn again. "I'm hiding in the ladies' toilet," he whispered. "Where are you?" I ran to the terminal. The security man glanced at my ID and waved me through. I arrived with dramatic speed into a small grey departures hall of sleepy passengers. I found Finn was standing between two drinks machines, looking flustered.
"Have they gone?"
"Think we're in the boot of the bus, chasing it back to Inverness." Just then, a high-vis-vested man at the desk called the flight through the tannoy. The room wasn't big enough to warrant a tannoy, he could just have said it. We queued, showed our tickets and were directed out to a propeller plane on the tarmac. It was small, a puddle hopper, just three seats across inside. We sat next to each other. I was shaking, felt sick, so wired I could have ripped all the chairs out of their brackets without breaking sweat. It was incredibly hard to sit still. Finn took out his phone, checking his Twitter account. Precha's photo was up to 70,000 likes, but no one was talking about me anymore. I took out my own phone, carefully keeping the face pointed away from Finn, and searched hashtag justice for Buchanan. I was surprised and incredibly touched. There were threats and insults, but other people were challenging them, saying nice things about me, that I had courage, that I was young, that I had been lied about. Really, some of them were too nice and talked about me as if I were a sainted martyr. People were overtly mentioning Gretchen Tiegler, saying disparaging things, linking over and over to articles about a cop called Patricia Hummingsworth. Patricia had been jailed 6 years ago for taking bribes from Gretchen's PA, Dauphine Loire. Loire fought the case and was found not guilty. I shut the article and turned off my phone. I glanced at Finn's. He wasn't just looking at comments below Precha's picture. There was a fresh post from Finn, uploaded 15 minutes ago. It was an audio file. The likes and retweets on it were rolling up in the thousands as we watched. He smiled at it, terribly pleased. I recorded it in Departures before that man turned up. Is it a song?
No.
He put his phone on airplane mode.
It's a rough podcast about Leon Parker. 8 minutes, not much more than that.
Easy. Just a voice recording about Skibo and some screenshot images, but it's already doing really well.
He showed me the tweet. It had 7,000 likes already and the count was rolling up all the time. The stewardess was standing over us, smiling and looking at Finn's phone.
Have you put that off, sir?
He pressed the button and the phone went blank.
Off, he said, smiling back.
Thank you.
She walked back up to the front of the plane, sat in a flip-down chair facing us and did up her seatbelt.
Finn, what have you done?
He shrugged innocently.
I just said Leon didn't kill himself, that someone else was on board and took the photo.
His voice trailed away as he read my expression.
Finn, if there was someone else on that boat, then they've murdered 3 people. You've just broadcast the fact that we know.
The propeller started as the plane taxied to the runway. It was deafening.
I thought it might be fun.
Did you?
A bit fun.
The nose of the plane tipped sharply up. The tone of the propellers rose to a shriek, and I shouted as loud as I could,
"You're a vacuous idiot!"
Chapter 30. My heart was still racing as we landed, a heady mix of indignation and exhaustion. Gatwick was bland and enormous. We traipsed down blank corridors, up dreary escalators, through white doors. I was wildly alert to every man in dark clothes, every shady corner, every fresh jolt of the luggage conveyor belts. Through arrivals, we found ourselves in a row of cafes and shops. Finn led us into an open-sided Starbucks. He went up to order, taking his place at the end of a glacial queue, leaving me to listen to his podcast. It was shit. The sound quality was awful. The air con whirred in the background. You could hear people buying cans from the drinks machine and the toilet doors slapping shut. It lasted for 8 minutes. His voice was soft and conversational. He said he was going through some tough stuff and had gone off on an adventure with Anna MacDonald, his friend, which made me sound like a girlfriend he didn't want to admit to. He told the story briefly, and then he said we were investigating the Dana sinking, following on from the Death and the Dana podcast, that we didn't believe Leon had killed himself or his kids. He brought up the thing about the photo. Who took it? We thought there was a 4th person on board that night, and that we were planning to find out who, to solve one of life's little mysteries. He rounded it off with,
"So, until next time, mystery fans."
He came back with 2 coffees and a muffin. I pulled the earbuds out and dropped them on the table. He sat down, opened the muffin and tore it in half, eating a mouthful. He nodded at his phone.
"What do you think?"
"Life's little mysteries. It's a triple fucking murder."
By now, the tweet had 30,000 likes.
The count was escalating ridiculously fast.
He took another bite of his muffin.
"Trina Keeney said she'll meet us this morning."
"Shut the fuck up."
He ate the whole muffin himself. I didn't want any. It was vegan and tasted of despair anyway. I sipped my coffee. My head hurt. I didn't know whether to slap him or just get up and walk away. Beyond the open Starbucks, flocks of passengers floated past. Families came out of baggage reclaim with enormous wheeled bags, cranky and tired from long-haul flights. Business people scurried by with briefcases. I went back to my girls for comfort. My girls, on holiday. Waking up, tumbling from beds I had never seen, whispering to each other about what was going on with her dad, worried about me,
sneaking up and putting on the television before breakfast, as if it was a Saturday. My girls. I find you an incredibly angry person, Anna. Shut your anorexic fucking nuts, Finley.
Oh, I stand corrected.
I slapped his phone. What are you doing, advertising yourself on there?
I'm making a little amusing thing for people, a distraction from the misery of existence.
About my dead friend? That wasn't my real objection, but I was pissed off and very much wanted to win the argument. It stunned him quiet for a moment before he parried.
You started it. You made me listen to a story about his death.
He had me there.
Look, he said, I'm not being malicious. I'm just trying to bring a little joy to the world. People on Twitter are claiming that I'm dying. What does that say to other people with anorexia? I'm not dying. I'm living and being interested in the world. It matters because people are looking at me. I'm coping with a very difficult situation. Soon the word will be out that my wife's left me, that she's having a baby with some rich old lawyer. It's humiliating, but I'm coping with that. I want them to have something else to say about me, even if it's that I ran over your old boss, and by the way, I still don't know what that was about.
What?
Why I had to run over two men to get you...
No, back more.
My wife's left me?
I saw him slowly realise that I didn't know.
Having a baby.
His voice trailed off. My hand was still on his phone. He reached forward and put his bony hand over mine.
They didn't tell you. Oh, Anna.
A baby? No, they didn't tell me. We sat there for quite a long time. Finn finished his coffee. Mine went cold. I went cold. After 10 minutes or so, he stood me up and walked, and then we took a lift down. We bought tickets and we got on a train. The train set off. The carriage wasn't busy, but someone recognised Finn. I saw her do a double take and look away. She tried to take a photo of him on her phone, smirking as she held it up for the shot, pretending to read something. It was so obvious, and she was smug and mean about it. It made me feel even worse. When she got off, I whispered, "Couldn't the baby be yours?" Finn didn't answer for a long time. His breathing was irregular. I felt he was only just holding it together and didn't want to press it. We passed through two stations before he spoke.
You don't understand.
I did a bit, but I could see it wasn't volitional. Did starvation do something to his sperm count or make him impotent? There was no way of asking that wasn't insulting. A baby. They would stay together. They would form a new family. Estelle was great. Hamish was lucky. The girls would be delighted with a baby, but Finn and I? We were finished. We were extras in our own lives, marginal asides to the people we loved the most. I felt as if I was sliding off the side of the world. I started crying. Finn took my hand and held it until I stopped. Then we held hands as we sat on the rickety train, rolling into a grey November London. It wasn't romantic, it wasn't sexual. We held hands like Hansel and Gretel on their first night in the forest. We were both sad, and I think we were both grateful that someone else was there. Someone kind. Chapter 31. I wasn't planning to meet Trina Keeney. I just didn't want to be alone. Somehow, though, her resistance to us made me feel a burning loyalty to Finn and our ridiculous project. Or maybe I was just playing a part and got very into it. I was ambivalent when we turned up, is the point. By the end of it, I'd have walked through a wall for our right to broadcast his next ramble. That was why I went into the travel agents afterwards and bought 2 flights to La Rochelle. We were walking up a busy side street off Oxford Circus when we saw Trina sitting outside a cafe. She was alone at a little metal table, reading something on her phone. It was narrow and noisy, and the pavement was littered with bins and trestle blackboards. It wasn't a street anyone would choose to sit out in, but there was no ashtray on the table and she wasn't smoking. Trina was young and slim, chocolate-coloured skinned with a lot of freckles. Her hair was black, worn in dry twist-outs, frizzy at the ends. A blue lanyard hung around her neck under her grey suit jacket. Even from quite far away, she seemed agitated. She looked up, spotted us walking towards her, and her eyes brightened for a second at the sight of Finn. She obviously recognised him, but then her face snapped shut, her lips tightened, and she got her defences up. I didn't think the meeting was going to go very well. It was fair enough. Finn had put out a podcast contradicting her, and he did it without contacting her about it first. It occurred to me that for all his formality and old-world charm, Finn could be mercenary. We all introduced ourselves, shook hands, and pulled up chairs. Her lanyard was for the BBC building round the corner. Finn apologised for negative reactions she had received to his podcast response. She shook her head and chewed her cheek. "Doesn't matter," she said, though it clearly did. "People are downloading us to find out what it is you're contradicting. You've bumped us up the charts." The familiar timbre of her voice, her intonation, it took me back to the kitchen before everyone got up, to the bathroom with Hamish banging on the door, to the desperate drive up the loch side. I couldn't stop looking at her lips, wishing she would speak again. Finn said,
"So you work at the BBC?"
She nodded. "Admin, not making anything."
"But you want to be a broadcaster?"
She frowned. "Look, dispensing with formalities, you can tell the bitch that I won't take it down."
"What?"
"I am surprised it's you, honestly, because I've always liked your music." Just then the waiter came out and interrupted us. We ordered tea. Trina waited sullenly, glaring at the table and at me. She was very blunt and angry. I won't lie, I liked her a lot. The waiter went back inside and she said, "Is she paying you? Or are you celebrity friends? Is that how it works?"
"Who are you talking about?" said Finn. "Gretchen Tiegler?"
"Not that one," Trina said. "She got you to make it, didn't she?" The growl of a bin lorry engine in the next street reverberated on the windows of the buildings around us.
"Sorry?"
said Finn, shouting over the traffic.
"Who are we talking about?"
Trina clicked her tongue and sneered. "Okay, then." The tea arrived on a tray and we all sat and watched the waiter put it down, spill the milk on the brushed metal table, clean the table, take the money, feel in his pocket for change. During all of this, Trina Keeney was agitated, juddered her leg under the table, her eyes darting as she mentally rehearsed the next bit of the argument. The waiter left and Finn tried again.
"Trina, sorry, what do you think is going on?" "Why did you agree to meet us?"
She thought about it for a moment. "Why did you want to meet me?" I explained that we wanted to ask her about some things in the case, that we had unanswered questions, but she was making faces all the way through, expressions that related in no way to what I was saying, and I just sort of petered out and gave up. Finn took over again.
"For example, what happened to the necklace?"
She narrowed her eyes. "You know perfectly fucking well." "No, we don't know." This was me shouting in exasperation, but the street was so noisy I don't think I sounded particularly angry, just very clear. "Gretchen Tiegler was sent the necklace in the post." We were both shouting now, and it wasn't for purposes of clear diction. We were all lost in the conversation, but Finn was lost.
Gretchen Tiegler? It is her now.
Trina turned to him.
As if you don't fucking know.
He held his hands up.
Okay, everyone needs to calm down.
So, I said, you think Tiegler sent us? Trina sat back.
Are you going to say she didn't?
Trina, look. I held my fringe up, showing her my eyebrow. At first she was confused, but then she looked at me closely, examining my scar. We locked eyes. She looked away and mouthed a curse. She turned back slowly to me and said quietly, I'd like to talk to you about that. I muttered, I don't talk about that. Everyone thought you were dead. Where have you been all this time? Hiding. The other girl, was she with you? I shook my head. We never met. She hissed at me. It's Tiegler again. I know, I said. I couldn't believe what I was hearing you say on the podcast. I couldn't believe you had the guts to call her out. I didn't know I was calling her out. I've never heard of her before. I might never get to speak to her again, so I just blurted it out. Trina, no one tells the truth about her. No one stands up to her. I can't tell you what it meant to me yesterday. She was suspicious of that. So what? So, thank you. Also, you have a lovely voice. Nice tone. She nodded at the pavement. Well, that's nice, but I didn't know not to say those things. But thanks. Finn wasn't following this conversation, and he was straining to hear us over the noisy traffic. He suggested we go for a walk. Trina said okay, she had 40 minutes left of her lunch. We walked east to a quieter street and kept going. Finn said to Trina,
we got interested in the story because my friend Anna was listening to your podcast and knew someone you mentioned in it.
Your friend Anna knew someone? She smiled from one to the other. I shook my head softly and she realised that Finn wasn't being facetious, that he didn't know.
Anna was friends with Leon.
I nodded. I knew Leon 9 years ago, way before he married Gretchen. He was going out with a Dutch woman. I worked in a hotel that they stayed in. I don't think he did it. I'm sure he didn't kill himself.
9 years ago, you didn't think he would kill himself? That's wishful. It's an impulse, not a fixed character trait.
I suddenly knew she was right. It was a passing impulse. It was a circumstance. I'd never thought of it like that. I was so relieved at that possibility. I hadn't inherited my fate. I didn't need to pass it on to my girls. None of it was inevitable.
Trina whispered, "You think I was wrong?"
I think Leon had come close, but didn't do it. He's been in worse situations and didn't do it. I think there was someone else on board the Dana that night. No, I mean, was I wrong to arrive at a conclusion? Usually true crime podcasts finish up by saying, we may never know. It's such a cop-out. That's what I thought. That's why I was definitive and said it was him. Now I'm more convinced than ever that she covered it up. Weren't you frightened of a backlash? She sighed. Honestly, I had no idea about Gretchen Tiegler. I mean, I knew she was rich, she came from a strange background, but who could know she'd be like that? I didn't even blame her in the podcast, I just said that her power could have distorted what the police did. It's not that controversial. I'm fucking terrified of her now, though. I'm sick of being terrified of her. We were in a broad street with a lot of speed bumps, trees, a softer soundscape. Ahead of us, Finn stopped and turned to an open gate, waving us to him. We followed him into the forecourt of the British Museum. Up the stairs and through the door, we stopped at the desk and the security guard checked our bags. We walked through a metal detector, emerging into the strange grey twilight in the glass-covered courtyard. We wandered westward and sat on a bench. Finn and I on either side, Trina Keeney in the middle. We were looking at the back of the Rosetta Stone set upright in a glass case. The tourists were gathered on the other side of the glass, looking towards us but not seeing us. "It's Tigla," she told Finn. "She contacted me about the podcast."
"Gretchen Tigler threatened you?"
"Not directly. She sent someone. They ordered me to take the podcast down. Upsetting to the family," she said. "Unethical disregard for her feelings, all that stuff. She chose that cafe where we just met because it's so noisy."
"So that you couldn't tape her?"
"Exactly."
"And you chose it so we couldn't secretly tape you?"
She gave an apologetic shrug. "I didn't know who you were or who you were working for. She was very threatening. She offered me money to take it down. I refused and she threatened to get me kicked off the network. Then they went to see the owner and he told them to fuck off, and then they tried to buy the network off him for 40 grand. He's from a rich family, thank God, didn't need the cash. I'd have caved. Anyway, the podcast is the number 3 download today because you said it was a bucket of crap. The more prominent it is, the safer I'll feel."
"I didn't say it was a bucket of crap."
"You kind of did."
"We loved it. We just disagreed with your conclusion. 40 grand doesn't seem like much."
"Really? Well, I think it's a lot. Podcasts don't make money."
"But you're sponsored."
"Barely covers studio time. We don't get paid. Patreon is a big waste of time unless you've got profile."
"You're making them for free?"
"Yeah. I don't mind. I love doing it. You don't have to convince a committee of bored execs while your enthusiasm wanes. You can just make it and put it out and people can listen or not. It will change, but that's what it's like right now."
"I love that," nodded Finn, smiling warmly. "Like the start of rock and roll."
"Someone will find a way to make them pay and it'll be professionalised, but we're not yet, and we're very vulnerable. We don't really have editors or corporate structures to check what we're saying or warn us. Tigler is a nasty nutjob, but if no one is allowed to say it publicly, how the hell am I supposed to know? You try not to slander or insult, but you can't get it wrong by accident with scary rich busters and just apologise. It doesn't work like that." Suddenly she stopped and stiffened at the sight of a woman walking in a gallery nearby. For a moment, Trina watched her and then relaxed. "Not her."
"Is that like the person who came to see you?"
"Yes. Slim, blonde, neat. You couldn't really describe her, just bland, icy manner. Gave me the right creeps."
"What did you say about Violetta's necklace?"
"I only heard that after I'd finished the podcast. I was going to add it in later, but you could spend forever revising these things. Gretchen Tigler was sent the necklace a week after the Dana went down. It came in the regular post in a padded envelope, and she threw the envelope away before she knew it was significant."
"That's a lie."
"Yeah, but that's the story she told the police. Gretchen was in Paris when the Dana sank, in case you're wondering."
"Did you hear anything about Leon's financial situation?" Finn asked.
"Yeah. Leon was bankrupt. He bought the Dana cheap to resell back in England. Had a buyer. He was just sailing it from Corfu. But he was totally broke."
"No," I said. "He owned a house worth millions."
"Mortgage to the hilt," said Trina. "He was trying to sell it. People get desperate. You should be asking about Emila. I've got a picture."
She found it on her phone. It was a cutout from a magazine article. A photo of a slim, dark woman in immaculate chef whites, standing in front of the window of an old-fashioned bouchon, gold lettering sweeping across the glass behind her. Over her forearm was the handle of a wide wicker plate, tipped towards the viewer to show off the bread. The bread was the object of interest both to the photographer and to the woman. She smiled pacifically down at the bread basket. The caption in French read, "La Dame du Pain."
"Is that her?"
"Yeah.
Something happened to Emila. I don't know what.
She isn't appealing the case. I don't know if she's being forced not to, or blackmailed, or just getting bad legal advice.
I went to the loo and Trina followed me. I knew she wanted to talk. She waited until we were both washing our hands and she caught my eye in the mirror.
Finn Cohen doesn't know what you're doing, does he?
He didn't, and I felt bad about that. She shook her hands dry.
You know what happened to the other girl who came forward in your case?
Yeah, that's why I stayed away.
Well, you were wrong too. They had to identify her body from her dental records. She shouldn't have gone into hiding. They were the only people really looking for her.
If I was her, I'd have gone and stood next to the fucking queen and shouted it all through a megaphone. We left on good terms, promising to keep in touch. Trina hugged me and whispered that I was a hero. She meant well, but heroes are usually dead. We parted in the street and promised to keep in touch.
We booked flights for the next day. Then we went and found a run-down hotel.
It smelled of cabbage. Two rooms were stupidly expensive, but I paid for them with my resettlement cash.
I plugged my phone in to charge and lay across the bed, falling asleep with my shoes and coat on. I slept like the dead, like the other girl, and I dreamed of coming apart under the sea and not caring anymore.
Chapter 32. Passport control was at the dark end of a long corridor. I wanted Finn to stand well away from me. I was using Sophie Buchanan's passport, and if I had been declared dead, I might get hauled off. I didn't want him implicated. He knew something was up and didn't want to take separate lines, so I made it a game, like tricking Lizzie into eating broccoli by saying they were trees and she was a giant. Let's make it a race, I said. Make it fun. Finn smiled and said, yeah, but he was humouring me. He didn't really understand the game. He was on the other side of the ribbon, waiting for his window, standing on one leg, scratching his arm, fiddling with his phone. I tried to mimic his insouciance, but it came out stiff and odd. I hopped about, scratching at myself, stood up tall, swallowed a lot. Finn tried to make a joke across the barrier, but I ignored him. He looked a bit hurt, but then he was called forward to his window.
Hi, Wynn,
he called back to me. I shook my head and looked away as if he were a mad stranger. There was only one person in front of me, a white backpacker with blonde dreads and an ethnic print patchwork shirt. He slouched over the counter. The customs man ordered him to step back, sounding fierce and firm. He looked at the hippie's passport, looked at the hippie, looked at the passport. The backpacker made a joke and laughed. The customs man didn't laugh. He held the backpacker's eye as he fed the passport into the chip reader and slapped it down on the counter with an eye roll. The backpacker took it and hurried away. My turn. Damp and breathless, I stepped forward and handed over Sophie Buchanan's passport. He put the page down on the scanner and looked at me. He looked at the photo. He looked at me. He waited. A light changed below him and he put the passport back on the counter. I lifted it, but he tugged it back. Remember to renew next year, madam. Thank you. Finn was waiting for me on the other side.
Okay.
I nodded. I was trembling.
We floated through duty-free. Chocolates and handbags, bright white lights. The shops were beautiful. Everyone moved in an orderly dance, skirting one another with perfect poise. My passport worked. I had 8 months left on it. I could go anywhere. All over the world, I could hear doors swinging open. Doors onto beaches and fields and cities. Athens, Paris, Jaipur, New York, New York. My passport worked. I could go anywhere. Somehow we ended up in a shop full of watches. A young woman asked Finn for a selfie.
She took it and walked away without saying thank you or goodbye, but Finn didn't even seem to notice. People are so rude. He was very calm about the whole thing.
They don't mean to be. They forget that you're a person. It's just the deal. I was so young when we got famous. I wouldn't have consented if I'd known what it would be like, but it's done now. I sold my face for a pittance. He shrugged. Anyway, people are giving their faces away for nothing now.
We walked on, revelling in the luxury mall atmosphere.
They've got vegan chocolate,
said Finn dreamily, looking across to a big fancy shop. I followed him into a purple and gold shop where you could choose the chocolates individually from a big glass cabinet. It was hard to hang on to the indignation because of the passport. I had never dared to dream of travelling.
Which one do you want?
I pointed vaguely at a small nutty one and watched him catch the server's eye. My God, I had the option of running again. Not to say I would do that, but the possibility was elating, like finding an air pocket in a car I was drowning in. Then we were outside the shop and Finn was eating a very big chocolate he clearly didn't want. It was the size of a child's fist. He took a bite, licked his lips and hummed, chewing and chewing and chewing. I shoved mine in my mouth and chewed it a bit and swallowed. It was horrible, a sort of oily chocolate, and mine wasn't even the vegan one.
Nice, isn't it?
He smiled. I'm not fussed about chocolate. I was swithering about whether to tell him about the passport, let him share in the joy, but it was a complicated story and I was more practiced at not telling it. Finn put the rest of his chocolate in his mouth and I suddenly saw a man across the concourse filming us on his phone. I turned away and watched the man's reflection. He was smirking as he filmed, aware that Finn was a famous anorexic eating a big chocolate. He seemed to think it was funny. I looked at Finn. He knew he was being filmed. He wanted people to see that. He was doing it for the benefit of people he would never meet, people who might get better. I could see from his eyes that it pained him to eat it, that he was incredibly anxious, but he did it anyway. It was a brave performance and it was humbling to witness. Finn, I need to come clean about something.
Hmm?
He was still pretending to enjoy the chocolate, but his eyes were brimming. The man stopped filming us and moved away. My name is Sophie Buchanan. Does that mean anything to you?
No.
I was raped by 4 footballers in a hotel 10 years ago. It was a big case. They were found not guilty. He didn't know what to say. He watched my lips as if he was waiting for a tasteless punchline. Gretchen Tiegler owns that football club. After the case ended, someone tried to kill me in my house and I ran. Everyone thought I'd been murdered. Several people have died in suspicious house fires. They all stood in Gretchen Tiegler's way. Finn looked as if he might be sick, but he managed to mumble,
Sophie Buchanan.
That photo of you and me on the steps outside my house, it proves I'm alive. They can't take the chance that I'll speak out again, not now. That's what was going on at Skibo. Finn blinked hard.
Look, could we go and sit down and you can tell me this again?
Yes.
Anna, I'm going to be sick.
No, you're not. We'll just walk very slowly and I'll rub your back and tell you the story. Chapter 33. It was warm and bright in Saint Martin. We stood on the dockside, stiff from the plane and the taxi ride. A breeze was on my cheek, the faint smell of fish and soap mingling on a warm, caressing wind. I felt very far away from everything. The setting felt hyper-real because I was here twice, in the imagined town from the podcast and the real place, moving through history and imagination and reality. All the Saint Martin seemed equally matched and clashed and melded in my mind. That was where the prisoners filed onto ships bound for Devil's Island. There's the five-star Hotel Tarak. This was the street Violetta and Mark walked down to go and meet their dad. Leon passed just here with his kids, heading off to get beer and Fantas. Finn felt it too, but not as much as me. He hadn't listened to the story as if he was in it, and there was an extra layer of wonder for me because of the passport and the possibilities ahead of me. I was out of the UK for the first time since my mum died. I could go anywhere. Everything felt new and fresh. Finn said,
"Fancy a coffee?"
I slipped my arm through his. "I'm hungry." He said he could probably manage to eat something. He was eating. He wasn't enjoying it, but he was making himself. It was hard to watch him. We found a cafe on the busy dock, sat outside, and the waiter gave us big menus. I ordered a croque monsieur and asked if they did vegan food for my friend. The waiter tutted and was generally very irritated by the mention of veganism for some reason. He prodded Finn's menu. "You can have that, that, or that. Basically fries and salad." Finn said, "Okay then." The waiter snatched the menus and stomped off as if we'd ordered his mother's eviction. "Bit annoyed," I observed.
"A Frenchman who has tasted vegan cheese?" suggested Finn.
We looked around. Everything was stylish, understated, and a little bit twee. This is what we saw. The hotel on the dockside was a converted warehouse. It was a squat three-story building with a turreted stairwell and Moorish tiles around the door. The rooms had large windows with balconies looking out over the dock. My imagined dock was completely wrong. In my mind, it was a harbour of straight lines, but this was a tear-shaped inlet. In the middle stood a small island cluttered with modest fishermen's houses, warehouses, boat sheds, all converted into restaurants and holiday homes. A brick walkway led across to it, cutting the harbour in half. Only small craft could dock in the harbour. The tide was out, and the boats, lolling in the mud, were only 10 or 20 feet long. The Dana was 60 feet long. Too long for the dock, and too wide for the narrow harbour entrance. We smoked and speculated. Could the Dana have been docked over there? Could it fit there? I had imagined it right here in the very centre of town, next to the cafes and bars. We scanned for the rooftop restaurant that had overlooked it as it set sail, but we couldn't find that either. Finn suggested they might have docked further away and arrived on a smaller boat. No, because remember the gangplank was metal, and Amila came clattering down it and everyone looked. The Dana must have been here somewhere. Finn got his phone and mic out and said he was going to do a quick update about Trina Keeney being threatened and Amila's bakery. I'd been thinking about what Trina said about the other girl. "I think I should out myself," I said. "Just say I'm Sophie. The people who are interested will put it together. It might be safer than hiding."
"You sure?"
"Yeah," I said, though I wasn't. Finn fitted the special mic to his phone and we introduced ourselves. I just said I was Sophie Buchanan. I see from Twitter that some of you have heard of me. Then Finn did a straight, off-the-cuff, 10-minute update. It was quite impressive to watch. He listened back to it twice. When the food arrived, he made me take a picture of him eating chips. He posted it without asking me. I didn't think it was a good idea to identify our location, but he said we'd be out of there by tomorrow. "They have planes and everything, Finn. They've got people everywhere."
"Okay."
Finn didn't really believe me when I said we were in danger. I think he thought Skibo was a one-off. The reaction on Twitter was immediate. People commenting on the photo and retweeting, expressions of support for me, for Finn, for women, for whatever. Finn sat and ate, watching the numbers scroll up and up.
"Fuck. People know it's Saint Martin.
We'd better get out of here."
Let's give ourselves 2 hours. Loads of tweets about the ghost in the video. Why do people believe that?
People are idiots, I said.
Yeah, he sounded unconvinced. But we should mention it.
We should debunk it. I think I know exactly what happened.
Really?
Mark Parker was playing a joke. My phone jangled in my pocket. It was a text from Jessica. She was fine and having a nice time. The swimming pool had a tree in it, this done in emojis. The eight, emoji of a pizza. Estelle spewed, sad face. I texted back, I love you. I put in emoji hearts here because she likes those. I miss you like crazy. Got time for a chat? She didn't answer. I don't know why I asked. She doesn't even like speaking on the phone to her friends, but I was desperate to hear her little voice, to hear Lizzie's giggle. Then my phone rang. It was Jess calling and I answered excited, but heard Hamish. He sounded very angry. I didn't want to speak to Hamish.
What the hell are you doing in France?
How could he know that? I realised he must be following Finn on Twitter. Or more likely, Estelle was following Finn, saw the photo, knew we were together, and told Hamish where we were. If Hamish found out about Sophie Buchanan, he might use it to get the courts to refuse me visitation. Are the girls okay?
Anna, answer me. Are you in France?
Kind of. I don't know why I felt so guilty.
I have 2 things to say to you. Do not spend all of that money.
I'm not.
But I was. It's for the new flat. When that cash is gone, I can't access any more for 6 months without incurring a penalty. You've always been so frugal and sensible. What the hell is going on?
Why did you call me on Jess's phone?
He wasn't listening. Secondly, how the hell can you be in France? You wouldn't leave Glasgow for the last 3 years. And who is Sophie Buchanan? Is she with you? Well, you're in bloody Portugal, Hamish.
He went off on one about the money again. I didn't shout back, though. I didn't defend myself or counter-accuse. I didn't think anything could be said that would profit either of us. I listened, imagining Sophie, not Anna, listening to a rant from this mad old stranger. I thought Sophie would have told him to fuck off. I didn't think she would feel ashamed and cowed the way Anna did. Hamish, I said in my London accent, I know she's pregnant. And then I hung up. I felt nothing but tired. Not being goaded into an argument with Hamish felt like an ending. A real end to the thing. A door closing softly on a shoddy mess. Jess's phone called me again, but I knew it was Hamish. What a cheap move using her phone to make me answer. I didn't answer. I didn't have time for his head fuckery right now. Finn worked his way through the chips and salad, watching the likes and retweets rack up like the seconds of our lives passing. Has Estelle called you? He shook his head. Have you called her?
There's nothing to say.
She was following him on Twitter. She was talking to Hamish about him. She was probably listening to the podcast, but I think Finn knew that. I think, really, she was his audience for the chocolate eating and the chips. Maybe that was why he was with me, doing this at all. The whole performance was aimed at her. I couldn't hate him for it. I pitied him because it was over between Hamish and me, but I didn't think it was for them. I paid and he got up. Come on, let's go and see if we can find anything. We sauntered casually away from the harbour, when what we should have done was run and kept on running. Chapter 34. The streets were pedestrianised and cobbled, brushed with a layer of sandy dust like the leavings of a hot summer. The locals were dressed for an Arctic winter in scarves and jumpers and gloves. I was sweating. We walked half a mile to the bar where the Dana's crew had watched football.
Finn wasn't sure we'd get a friendly reception. He balked at the door, but I went straight in and ordered a demi-beer. It was a narrow galley with a yellow formica bar. A television hung high on the wall at the far end. The barmaid served me and saw Finn loitering outside the door. She waved encouragingly at him to come in. He said no, it was okay. Then she offered him a bowl of peanuts as an inducement, as if he was a shy woodland animal, and we all laughed about it. I got him a demi and he came in and drank some.
"You are Finn Cohen? A musician?"
He said he was. She said her friend was the manager of the Hotel Tarak. His name was Hector, and he had texted her to say that Finn Cohen had been spotted in town. He was a crazy fan. She rolled her eyes. A crazy super fan. I tried a few questions, but she wasn't keen to talk about the Dana. She said she only started working here a year ago anyway, came from Warsaw and knew nothing about it. The crew were here all night, and that was all she'd heard. It felt like a triumph of sorts, getting a reluctant witness to speak, and I tipped her, though it isn't the custom in France, and she took it because she was Polish and well-travelled enough to know I wasn't trying to be rude. We went off to find Mark Parker's Airbnb. We had booked it while we were waiting to board at Heathrow. The listing said it was situé au cœur de la cité. It looked grim in the photos. It boasted bed type, real bed, but looked like a single futon. A decorative fan was pinned on the wall at a strange angle, possibly as a cover-up for a damp patch. No pets, no smoking, no parties. We found the street very quickly. It was broad with stone benches shaded by shedding pine trees. The house was down a side alley. It needed a coat of paint. Stratified black dust had settled on the white, lime-washed walls. The front door was plastic, cheap and moulded to look like wood. I knocked and we listened. A mop handle clattered to a stone floor. After a moment, the door was opened by a young, very tall, bald man, and I introduced myself as his tenant for the evening.
"No luggage?"
"No." He opened the door to the wall. "Come in." He led us up a dark corridor, past a mop propped in a corner as if it was in time out. We came to a small door and he opened it, turned to us and shrugged.
"Vous avez payé, mais..."
He gestured to my expensive leather coat and shrugged again. The room smelled bad and looked awful. The window was dirty and a corner crack was mended with yellowing sellotape. The stone floor was still wet from the mop. It stank of tangy, synthetic lemon. I smiled at him, which surprised him. "I'll pay you for 3 more nights in cash right now, and then my friend and I will leave and you'll never see us again." He looked at us from one to the other.
"For what?"
"We want to ask about Mark Parker."
"Why?"
"I want to know about his luggage." As I say, he was tall, about 6'5", and had to stoop in the low corridor. He looked over our heads regretfully.
"This island is so small," he said. "There are much people here who don't want to talk of these things. It's difficult."
He wanted more money. I said, "Okay, never mind. You keep the payment for tonight, and sorry to have bothered you." I turned to leave.
"No."
I turned back.
"Come in here."
He waved us towards a bigger door that led into a kitchen. The house was small and narrow. To accommodate the addition of a kitchen, the back of the house had been knocked through and a boxy glass conservatory built on. This room smelled weird too, the same kind of lemony weird. I began to think the smell was coming from the man. He sat us down on a mottled pink and grey sofa and I counted out the cash. When he was sure it was the right amount, he nodded and began. Mark Parker booked that room only 1 week before he has arrived. He was lucky to achieve this room. Many have said it is not a good room, but it is good enough for one night and is well priced. Very cheap. Why not? People of no money cannot stay here now. It is a rich place. Cheap places are necessary, are they not?
They are indeed. Did he remember Mark arriving at the door?
Certainly he did. He remembered very much detail because